Michael Perlman is professor of economics at California State University in Chico. His books include Class Warfare in the Information Age, The Pathology of the U.S. Economy Revisited, and The Perverse Economy, The Impact of Markets on People and the Environment. He also recently published Steal This Idea, Intellectual Property Rights and the Corporate Confiscation of Creativity, which is being released in paperback this month. Michael, we'd like to welcome you to this special broadcast for the Symposium on Intellectual Property Rights and Traditional Knowledge.
Oh, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I guess for starters, Michael, issues around intellectual property rights have spurred a lot of absurd scenarios, particularly in the courts. Can you give us some examples of the types of bizarre claims and litigations that intellectual property rights give rise to?
That's hard to do because anything I tell you today is going to be topped by something more absurd tomorrow. People have talked about or tried to patent things such as athletic moves that people do on the sports field, special patterns of cutting in surgery, that is cutting with a little arc rather than cutting straight. People have patented a number, actually a number. People have patented a color. There's virtually anything that you can think of. If you can write it in an obscure way, then you can make it sound like you've done something novel. And the overworked and underpaid patent examiners don't have time to really evaluate what it is, and it goes through.
In Steal This Idea, you write that, quote, intellectual property rights have contributed to one of the most massive redistributions of wealth that has ever occurred. I was wondering if you could expand on this.
Well, it's very simple. Anybody who gets sick, perhaps not in Canada, but certainly in the United States, pays an enormous amount of money. And that money comes essentially from taxpayers who give their money to the government researchers who then develop new discoveries, who then turn it over to private companies, who then patent some drug, who then charge exorbitant fees for that drug. So in effect, money is taken from people as taxpayers, as consumers, and given over into the pharmaceutical companies. And this is matched over and over time and time again.
You mentioned how costs are like, the costs for the stuff is socialized while the benefits of intellectual property rights are privatized in that sense.
Exactly.
How does this distribution of wealth play out on a global scale?
Well, on a global scale, what happens is people come into a country like India, they patent something like the neem tree, which is a traditional form of medicine, a traditional source of medicine. They come, they patent that, they patent something like basmati rice, and then they will expect to charge people for using this, even the people who actually have discovered it in the first place on the international sphere. Intellectual property rights mean that there's much more secrecy, so it means that people globally have less access to information. The information is, again, published by professors working in the public sphere, taken over by corporate journals, who then charge as much as $10,000 per year for a subscription, which cannot be afforded in many countries. So they're just cut off from information, which makes them fall further behind in the race to accumulate wealth based on intellectual property rights.
I think to come to an understanding of the role of intellectual property rights in today's society, I propose we go back. Tell us about the origins of the market economy and the role that intellectual property rights has played in the development of capitalism as we know it today.
Well, actually, they play a very minor role in the development of capitalism. That is, if we think about our own country, the United States was founded on the idea that intellectual property was fairly non-existent except for patents, which were put into the Constitution more or less as an afterthought. Regularly, people would take books and novels that were published in Europe and they would be reprinted here in this country, and nothing whatsoever would be given to the author. The reason was that the United States at the time was a net consumer rather than a net producer of intellectual property, and so we routinely violated the intellectual property of others. It was only when the United States began to be a predominant accumulator of intellectual property that suddenly intellectual property rights become sacrosanct. Now, if you look at back early in, not at the origins of capitalism, but if you look at the time of Charles Darwin, Darwin's career began by going off on a ship, working with a crew that was trying to take what we might call intellectual property today, that is knowledge of plants and animals, and to take what they were doing is they would take samples back to England. They would go to Kew Gardens. Kew Gardens today is thought of by most people as a beautiful place for tourists to see exotic plants. But the plants were taken there. They were bred. And they were bred in a way that they could be replanted in British colonies, and then the British would come over and they would take people from different parts of the world for cheap labor and move them in. Say they would take people from India into work plantations in Malaysia and the like to take the rubber that they took from Brazil. So the point being that intellectual property wasn't a very important part of early capitalism. And in fact, you can make the case that modern Western capitalism grew and developed because of the absence of intellectual property. Let me explain. What we think of today is that modern scientific and technological advancements were key to the development of what we call capitalist state today. What made Western science burst out ahead of the rest of the world, because if you go back to, say, 1400, say, Western science was not particularly advanced. What was happening was that various members of the nobility would hire themselves a scientist, a Leonardo da Vinci, say, as an ornament. And then they could say, you see, I have the great Leonardo da Vinci. He works in my court. And you see what a great person I am. Now, eventually, as science developed, the nobility were unable to distinguish who was the great scientist and who wasn't. So one noble person could have a Leonardo da Vinci, another noble person could just have a Michael Perlman. And the nobility needed a way in which they could distinguish who was the great scientist from who was the mediocre scientist or the fraud. As a result, they set up what were called scientific societies. In England, it was the Royal Society. And these scientific societies were places where scientists would meet, and they would communicate with scientists from other countries, and they would bring their theories. And it would be the society itself that would bestow the type of honor on various scientists that would allow the nobility to know what kind of scientists they were buying. So it was a form of branding organization. But what it did was it meant that what we now call intellectual property, scientific information, was freely spread all around the Western world. And this created a flowering of science. Whereas today, with our intellectual property system, what we have is something entirely different, where in the rush to patent, you want to make sure that nobody else can catch up to you, so you keep your information as secretive as possible. You make it difficult to find. And then what will happen is, after you have the patent, any scientific or technological advance that you make is going to depend on the work of hundreds, perhaps thousands of people before you. As a result, you're going to fall into a morass of patent disputes as to who developed what and who deserves what percentage of the scientific credit for doing this, and it just leads to litigation, litigation, and more litigation.
I wanted to bring you back to you talking about intellectual property rights being very instrumental today for the so-called first world economy. Could you expand on that?
Well, if you think about the United States today, and I think more about the United States than Canada, so you'll have to forgive me for this. If you think about the United States today, where is it that we have a comparative advantage? What we see is that the types of things that we're dependent on, oil, more and more even food, they're increasing in number and in importance. And the things that we can export, that the rest of the world needs from us, they're declining in importance because people in China, people in India can do what we can do just about as well as we can, especially because in the United States, we're letting our educational system deteriorate in the hopes of privatizing it and making it into a business, and in an effort to keep taxes as low as possible. The tax problem is worse than the other. So what is it that the United States can export easily? Well, we have our weapons. But other than our weapons, our major exports are coming to be intellectual property. We're coming to export royalties. That is, we're demanding countries around the world pay royalties for intellectual property. We're exporting music. We're exporting films. We're exporting software. That is, virtually everything that we are developing a comparative advantage in is heavily dependent on intellectual property. So it becomes very, very important for the U.S. to be able to trade, in effect, intellectual property for things like oil. Now, this is very difficult because at the same time we're becoming more dependent on intellectual property, our intellectual property system is making our colleges and universities less effective. To make matters worse, we have all this thing about homeland security, which is cutting the United States off from more and more from the influx of bright students from the rest of the world, which is decreasing our ability to produce good science. So here we are developing a system in which intellectual property becomes central to our economic future, and yet what we're doing to create intellectual property is cutting off the lifeblood of this activity, which is supposed to be what we specialize in.
Can you describe the, I guess, the machinations of how the patent system actually works on the in the international arena?
The United States is demanding that other countries make their patent system conform more or less to our own patent system. And they're very, very emphatic in pushing poor, underdeveloped countries to accept the sort of intellectual property rights that we develop in this country. So this came to play during the election of 2000, for example. That is, at the time, the United States was demanding full price from Africa for AIDS medicine. AIDS medicine cost many, many times more what the average African person would be making, even if they were able to work. If they were suffering from AIDS, of course, then the cost would be even more prohibitive. And the point man in the Clinton administration to make sure that the AIDS drug prices would be high, meaning that the American pharmaceutical companies would get their full claims for their intellectual property rights, was Al Gore. And this became a sore issue until the ACT UP group started chanting wherever Gore was appearing, AIDS kills, AIDS kills, AIDS kills. And eventually the United States let up, in which they agreed, in effect, that the South African government, not Africa in general, but South African government would have the right to use generic AIDS drugs. But of course, the fine print in the agreement was far, far less generous than the public relations relief that the Gore campaign got from this agreement. So intellectual property is expected to be respected by countries all around the world, and they continue to do so. And of course, even any country that would defy the United States in that respect would be cut off from trade with the United States, or boycotts, or even military force, if it came to that.
What have been the responses from countries across the world in response to this, Americanized agenda for intellectual property rights?
Until the Cancun WTO meeting, mostly they were compliant. I don't know what exactly, because these things happen behind closed doors, whether they were bullied or promised something, but mostly they've been compliant. Lately, since Cancun, there seems to be some resistance, and we don't know how long that resistance will hold up.
I'd like to talk a little bit now about treating knowledge as a commodity. You talk about this both in Steele, this idea, as well as in class warfare in the information age.
Mm-hmm.
Can you explain, there's that old anarchist dictum of property is theft. I was wondering if you could explain that a bit, and would you draw a parallel from this to the notion of intellectual property?
Let's talk first about intellectual property as theft. Nobody invents anything. That is, there's never been anybody in the history of the world who's invented anything. And by that I mean all information, all ideas depend on what goes before them. So if I come up with a new idea, I do so because I have drawn upon the work and the experience of generations of people before me. What the patent system means is that I take this flow of information, where the information is really a river, and I'm only a single molecule of water in that river, and suddenly one individual says, I claim credit for the whole thing. I would think that's theft, because no one person really did it. One of my favorite examples of this was the telephone. It turned out that the two people patented or tried to patent the telephone on the same day, unbeknownst to each other. That is, it wasn't that there were two people working together and they rushed out of the workshop to get to the patent. But two people were working in parallel lines to patent the telephone. And it happened that Alexander Graham Bell got there in the morning and Elisha Gray got there in the afternoon. And Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone, as everybody knows. So it becomes difficult to think of a fair patent system unless you have a way of distinguishing, and there is no way of distinguishing, who did what and who deserves credit for what. Now, the only way we have to figure out who did what or who deserves credit for what is the legal system. So what that means is that each of the contenders go into court, and these court cases are becoming increasingly expensive, millions and millions and millions of dollars for each individual court case. And as intellectual property becomes more finely embedded within the technological system, the prospect of court cases increases exponentially.
What are the implications of treating knowledge as a commodity?
Well, it doesn't work as a commodity, first of all. And here's the reason it doesn't. I have a brilliant idea. And I say, would you like to buy this from me, Pierre? And you say, sure, show me your idea. So I show you my idea. And you say, nah, I don't want to buy it. But the problem is, you already have it. So it's like going into a clothing store. You try on the suit. You take the suit back off. You put on your street clothes, walk out, and somehow you still have the suit. So it means the only way I can sell you the information is to keep it secret. So a real transaction in information depends on secrecy. And, of course, what makes information so valuable is the more it's shared, the more it's used, the more valuable it gets. Secondly, the reason information doesn't work as a commodity is the following. In economics, the first class you take, one of the first things you learn is that the price system should, under competitive conditions, set prices equal to the cost of producing one more unit. That's what competition does. That's what every class in economics teaches. Well, what's the cost of producing one more unit of information, that is, of replicating the same idea? The first person to invent, let's say, the binomial theorem in mathematics, the first person who did it might have taken years and years and years and years to develop it. It would take only 5 minutes for that person to explain it to the next person how they did it. And now the binomial theorem, all you have to do would be to go on the internet and you look at it, it's already there. it costs nothing to produce. Just as it costs nothing to produce another MP3 copy of a song or a piece of software. So what that says is under competition, the price of intellectual property would go to zero. Well, the producers of intellectual property say, well, if that happened, I wouldn't have an incentive to produce intellectual property. So to prevent the price from going to zero, you give the producer of intellectual property a monopoly. Nobody else is allowed to use that except under terms that you define. Of course, a monopoly is just the opposite of what capitalism is supposed to be. It's supposed to be based on a competitive system. So, in effect, what we have is a capitalist system that's not really based on capitalism when it's an intellectual property, because it's non-competitive and it's based on monopoly. For this reason, the strongest opponents of intellectual property have historically been people who believed in the market, competition. And what happens is, you can see this every time, is when the economy gets in trouble, when the United States, for example, has a deep recession or stagnation, then suddenly you start seeing greater calls for stronger intellectual property as a way to somehow strengthen the economy. And so there was virtually no support for intellectual property laws in the 1870s. Corporations would routinely steal ideas from inventors. In fact, there was one Supreme Court case regarding braking systems on the railroads, and the Supreme Court ruled, well, their ruling was really lifting material that was submitted by the railroad in their briefs to the court, and the Supreme Court ruled that the inventor deserved nothing because the idea was in the air, and if that person had invented, someone else would have. A decade later, in the 1880s, there was a serious recession. And what can we do to get out of the recession? And the problem in the recession was there was too much competition, and prices of manufacturing goods were going down because productive capacity was increasing faster than was the capacity of people to buy the stuff. And intellectual property at that time was not meant so much to be a means of giving an incentive to people to create more intellectual property, but the real purpose of intellectual property at that time was getting around the antitrust legislation and allowed the large corporations to share their patents and patent pools, and in that way they could restrain competition and get together and organize in ways that would be otherwise illegal. The next big upsurge of intellectual property comes in the 1960s, when the United States is suddenly getting into, for the first time in more than 100 years, the United States is getting into a deficit situation. That is, we started in the United States importing more than we were exporting. What can we do? Oh, we can charge more for intellectual property, and that will give us some benefits, and it will make it more difficult for people in other countries to compete with us. So again, you have a big upsurge in intellectual property. So I would argue that intellectual property is antithetic to a market economy, to capitalism. And if you're a good capitalist, a good believer in markets, then you should be very, very skeptical about intellectual property.
You also talk about how intellectual property rights confiscate creativity. Can you expand on that?
Well, they confiscate creativity in several ways. First of all, a friend of a friend invented a new type of crank for a bicycle, which is not round, and therefore it gives you a lot more power all the time. And what will happen, obviously, is one of the large bike companies, it will take over this idea, and this individual inventor, who's now selling little bits and pieces of what he's doing to specialized bike users, will lose, because there's no way that he could garner the wherewithal to fight a multinational corporation in a patent fight. So it's a confiscation in that respect. An individual inventor, when they exist, cannot protect his or her intellectual property because they do not have the resources to fight in the courts. That's one form of confiscation. Two, the second type of confiscation occurs because, as I mentioned before in the case of the pharmaceuticals, the public already paid for the intellectual property. That is, it supported the science that's then turned around and patented. So that's a form of confiscation. Three, even if the person who claims the intellectual property really did do the work that they say they did, it's a confiscation because they're claiming the right to all the information, all the work, all the research that went before him or her. So that's a third form of confiscation. Finally, even if that person had thought of the idea out of whole cloth and had not depended upon other scientists, other researchers, that it's a whole new theory of a whole new science that nobody ever thought about, then in that case, that scientist still owes a lot to society because that scientist had enjoyed the education and the upbringing from society as a whole. That is, we don't spring out of whole cloth as a fully blown scientist. We take advantage of what society offers us. So it's a one-sided deal, where the corporations are the only ones with the wherewithal to really win in court, and society, not just society today, but society in the past, has provided an enormous amount of information and other inputs to make this science possible, and all of a sudden, a single corporation steps in and said, all that is mine. So I'd call that confiscation. But there's something that goes beyond confiscation, and that would be destruction of creativity. And you get the destruction of creativity because the whole system becomes less friendly to creativity. When you work as a scientist in the corporation, it's rare that the scientist has freedom to explore what they would like to do, where their interests are. They're often pushed into doing something that is merely in the corporate interest and has little to do with science. It may be just modifying some little thing just so you can maintain the patent a little bit longer, even though it's not an improvement. Or it may be that they're just trying to get around the patent by copying something, what they call reverse engineering, and making that doohickey in a way that they can claim it really doesn't violate someone else's patent, which can require a lot of work. But it's not creativity. It may be creative in a sense, but it's not creativity in the sense that it's producing something new. It's just working around the patent system.
Can you elaborate on how corporate science and intellectual property, you've been talking about how it impedes scientific progress. Mm-hmm. Can you expand on that a little bit and give us an example?
Well, let me give you an example of how corporate science was able to promote progress, and then we'll look and see about the unique features. There are two laboratories in the United States that historically produced a huge number of Nobel scientists, two corporate laboratories. And the two laboratories had one thing in common. They were owned by corporations that were either monopolies or quasi-monopolies. And I'm thinking of IBM Labs and Bell Labs of the AT&T Corporation. Because these companies had so much monopoly profits, they didn't have to force their scientists to do something that would produce an immediate profit. And you had enormous creativity and intellectual ferment coming out of these places. Now imagine you have the same company like AT&T today spun off Bell Labs, and they put it in Lucent Corporation, which is a company which is under intense pressure from the stock market. Lucent can no longer allow Bell Labs to do the sort of free-ranging science that they used to do. They tell their scientists, what are you going to do to produce something that's going to give me a profit right away? Well, real science doesn't work that way. Real science, a scientist takes an idea that he or she thinks is going to be interesting, and they work on it. And when the profits come about, they come about in ways that nobody can ever expect. So, for example, in the early days of the computer, the presidents of IBM, I think it was the president of IBM who said that the total demand for computers in the modern world would be maybe 5 or 6, because it would be only used for science. And there was a statement laid, you know, what do you think they'd be used for? Accounting? With a question mark after that, to say they would never be used for something like accounting. But of course, we see computers being used everywhere in all sorts of places, even in places where we don't see them, in your cars and your refrigerators and the like. So if you have science and it's only you only see one narrow opportunity for it, that narrow opportunity, that narrowing of science, that making it more and more applied, less basic, less capable of having these openings that nobody could ever foresee, that kind of science becomes less possible. Because the real advances come in places that nobody would expect. So, for example, recently I'm reading about inkjet printers, and now they're talking about using the same technology for inkjet printers in places that nobody would ever have expected. That is, printing fabrics, well, that makes some sense, but they're using it, they're talking about putting it in ignition systems for automobiles to be able to give a finer mist and a more precise mist of gasoline to go into the carburetor. But it requires real science comes from a free-ranging world in which people can do what they want, can communicate what they want. In corporations, you can't communicate your science because that can give your competitors an edge. You want to keep your science as private as possible. And that's a cost that nobody can see that comes out of corporate science.
You spoke of the importance of knowledge being shared, that knowledge gains value through its use in that sense.
Yes.
What are the implications of, for example, in light of the conference we're holding here, what would the implications be in your eyes to basically bringing in traditional knowledge into the current, patenting it under this current system?
This gets into our problem before about how do you give credit for something that is not really done by one person? My degree was originally in agriculture economics, and I got very interested at the time reading about the difference between the corporate science, corporate agricultural science that was going on in the United States, and the intense knowledge that people had in indigenous societies of the biological systems around them. Very, very incredible types of things. So that now you have pharmaceutical companies trying to come and take the information, say, from a medicine man in South America who knows about cures for various types of drugs. Now, I don't know how you could give the patent to a particular medicine man or a particular tribe, but certainly to have a pharmaceutical company come and claim that as their own private knowledge seems to be outlandish to me. Maybe something should be given back to the federal government, but then you have the problem that the federal government might not be that sympathetic to making sure that the credit went to the indigenous people. It might go to people in the capital city. I wouldn't know the mechanics of it. But what I do know is that the system as it stands today is very exploitative of the traditional knowledge that people have accumulated. So, for example, I mentioned earlier the famous example of the neem tree in India, which has all sorts of uses, and pharmaceutical companies came in and they said, this is ours, we claim it. Not the tree itself, but the use of the tree for medicinal purposes. And all they did was they found something. They didn't do the invention. They didn't do the meticulous study. Now, of course, the people who were using the neem tree did this through trial and error. They weren't trying to figure out some sort of pharmaceutical advance, but they did. And then certainly they shouldn't be charged exorbitant fees when the medicine comes on the market. So I don't know what to do as far as a specific legal mechanism, but I do know that there are serious injustices being done.
Can you give us an overview of some of the social costs to this system of intellectual property rights?
Well, the social costs, the first social cost is that it is inimical to science. That is, secrecy and seeking immediate profit rather than thinking of science as a long-term process. It is inimical to scientific development. You had the costs coming into the legal system. That is, all the suits and countersuits, which are a terrible waste of resources. You have the unequal distribution of income associated with intellectual property. That is, the whole idea of intellectual property is there is one winner and everybody else is a loser. And you have all the ills that come out of unequal distribution of income, which includes more crime, more payments for security. You have with intellectual property rights, it creates a world in which there's less cooperation, less working together. So it seems destructive in every respect that I can see.
Do you have any ideas on what people have been doing or what people can do to, how do we get ourselves out of this mess?
Well, boy, I wish I knew. Now, there's something called the Creative Commons, and they're working very, very hard to take information and put it into the public domain so it doesn't become purely the property of one individual. But with corporate power increasing the way it is, it becomes very, very difficult to get around that. So, for example, I work in a state university without a graduate school, so we don't have a big scientific infrastructure. But when we hire people, one of the things we're looking for is, can you get grants? So what we've done in the United States is we've shortchanged the universities, we've cut off the public support for universities. Universities become more dependent on corporations, and then you have people. Do you have to hire people then who can do something that would be deemed useful by the corporation, and the corporation then would come and give money back to the university that way? I see us in getting more and more in a mess, and possibly the only hope will be that as this legal system becomes so huge, swallowing up more and more of the resources of society, we might get a backlash in which people will start to question. Especially corporations will start to question the wisdom of the route that they've chosen. But it's going to require a very, very, very strong, strong organizing. And what we just saw in the election in the United States is it's very difficult to even begin a discussion on a rational level. That is, in our country, we still have, 70% of the Bush supporters still believing that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction. So maybe it starts at the media. But certainly, we're going to have to get the word out of how destructive this system is. And it's been a very, very slow go so far. That is, there are only a handful of people who seem to be taking a great interest in this problem, and maybe that's justified given so many problems out there, but it certainly is something that is going to impose a very, very heavy cost on us sooner or later.
This current patent system, the intellectual property rights as they stand right now, they do not benefit the people. They don't benefit artists or scientists and the like. Whose interest do they really serve?
Well, I think we both know that. So your question is purely rhetorical. They serve the people who've been served all along by the system we live in. They work to redistribute wealth and income to those who already have lots of wealth and income.
You also say, let me quote you, that it should be no surprise that today, when knowledge and information are so crucial to the economy, that the tradition of looting the commons extends to knowledge and information. That's pretty much what we've been talking about. Can you tie that into the tradition of looting the commons?
Let me add on that by sort of skirting around the question, because our time, I think, is getting short, and there's something I think needs to be said. One of the problems with making it clear about what's going on with the system of intellectual property is that scientific advances take about 20, 30 years before they actually show up in, say, a consumer product. It takes a long time to go into fruition. So we have a tradition, a centuries-long tradition of relatively open science, and a relatively short period of corporate science being so dominant. So for centuries, we have been putting scientific information into the commons, making it available. And what's happening now is that the system of intellectual property is draining the commons. That is, it's using up the information. And when you do that, the outcome should be a rapid increase in the development of new applications, because all of your scientific resources are being focused into this idea of what can I do to make something now. But we're not reinvesting in the scientific commons very much. That is, we're shortchanging what we call basic science, the sort of science that will lead to the great products of the future. So we're looting the commons in the sense that we're draining all this previous information. We're not putting anything back to replace it. And that's what I meant by looting the commons. Over and above the idea of that I mentioned before, of corporate science being able to take information generated by tax-supported activities and then charging the public more. Is even if we forget about the distributional questions, there's a generational distribution we have to look at, in which we're not doing enough to really provide for future generations to enjoy the science that we should be doing today.
And like you just recently acknowledged, we're unfortunately quickly running out of time. I was wondering if there's any closing comments you'd like to throw out there, both to the listeners in the greater Fredericton area listening on CHSR-FM, and as well to all the participants here at the Symposium on Intellectual Property Rights and Traditional Knowledge.
First of all, I'd say thank you for even taking an interest in the subject. It's a very important subject. And with the problems that we have being generated so quickly, we're going to need all the information shared as much as possible, in order that we have any hope of making this world into a better world. So first of all, thank you for just taking an interest in it. Second of all, please, please, please get involved. Learn about it. Learn more. Do more. Organize. And maybe we can turn this thing around.
Michael, I'd like to thank you for joining us for this special broadcast for the Symposium on Intellectual Property Rights and Traditional Knowledge, sponsored by the Creators' Rights Alliance, the Department of Native Studies at St. Thomas University in Fredericton, the Native Student Council, and CHSR-FM. Thanks, Michael.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate it.